A bear mauling leaves a Fairbanks man dead. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Eisenbeck Road Project gets opposition from Southwest subsistence fishermen.
The Aleutians have more access to mixed stock salmon stocks, while our people on the river system are restricted.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska State Troopers say a man was mauled to death by a bear at a remote lake in the state's interior late last night. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the victim was 64-year-old Robert Weaver of Fairbanks. Weaver and an unidentified family member were at a cabin at George Lake, about 110 miles southeast of Fairbanks, when the attack occurred. The other family member sought shelter inside the cabin and called authorities. Responding troopers found Weaver's body outside. Peters says a trooper investigating the death encountered a black bear. The animal was killed and will be sent to Fairbanks for a necropsy to see if it was the bear that killed Weaver. Weaver's body will be sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. Peters says the other family member is traumatized but apparently uninjured. Following a sharp rebuke from a Superior Court judge, the Alaska Redistricting Board has decided to start redrawing the state's political boundaries. The process has been going on for almost 3 years, and the lines can have a serious impact on who ends up in the legislature. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The goal is to have a new electoral map within 2 weeks. The board's original plan had been to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide whether Alaska must comply with federal requirements to protect the influence of the native vote before the board started drawing their lines. But last week, a Superior Court described the strategy of using federal requirements as a starting point as a stalling tactic. The judge ordered the board to immediately start work on a map that complies with the Alaska State Constitution first, an approach that's known as the Hickel Plan. While the redistricting board has agreed to start the mapping process, they also moved to draft an appeal to the court order. They bristled at criticisms that the board isn't doing its job well, and that it's behaving in a partisan fashion to benefit the board's Republican majority. Board attorney Michael White emphasized that the court hadn't found any evidence of gerrymandering.
It ruled over and over and over again that there was no such thing, and that issue is dead and is not an issue at all in the courts.
During their meeting, the board also responded to the court's order that they hold public meetings on their plans, saying that they always planned on that. While their schedule is subject to change, the first of those should be in Anchorage on June 28th, followed by meetings in Juneau and Fairbanks in July. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says she plans on visiting King Cove and Cold Bay in August to investigate whether the region needs a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn will travel to the Alaska Peninsula villages later this month. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the Association of Village Council Presidents is trying to block construction of the road, saying it will disrupt migratory patterns for waterfowl.
The Department of Interior is reviewing its decision to block the road through the wilderness. AVCP, a coalition of 56 native villages in the YK Delta, has been opposed to the road through the wilderness for years. Myron Nanning leads the group. He says the Geese Western Alaska Natives rely on stopping the Eisenbeck Refuge before heading to Baja, California for the winter.
You know, we're concerned that once they build a road, it'll be an open access to those areas where the birds feed during their migration.
Environmental groups such as the Wilderness Society also oppose the road because of concerns for the bird habitat. Officials say the road will be fenced with cable, preventing people from using the road as an access to hunting grounds.
There's something else underlying here.
That's Stanley Mack, the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough.
There's always been an ongoing battle with the intercept fishery down here they call it False Pass.
Mack says he's invited Nanning and others from AVCP to the region before to look at the issues, the road, the bird habitats, only to be ignored. Nanning does not dispute he's using the road as a negotiating tool.
The Aleutians have more access to mixed stocks, salmon stocks, while our people on the river system are restricted from being able to harvest salmon for food. And, you know, if they can give in, maybe we might be able to give in on the birds issue.
Nanning spoke about the issue briefly with Interior Secretary Jewell during a recess of a Capitol Hill hearing this week. He says he hopes the department conducts government-to-government consultations with the Western Alaska tribes about the road. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Myron Nanning's stance on the road from King Cove to Coal Bay is puzzling for Larry Cotter, who is the president of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Community Development Association.
I have the highest personal regard for Myron, and I think that I understand the passion that the folks in his area have for Chinook salmon and chum salmon, and you know, the need to reduce bycatch of those species in the Bering Sea pollock fisheries.
APICTA, like the other five CDQ groups, has a substantial investment in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. Cotter says Chinook bycatch has been substantially reduced in the pollock fishery over the past 4 years, and tying the contentious bycatch issue to the road dispute is the wrong way to go.
I'm trying to hold the road to King Cove hostage to reduce salmon bycatch even further, I think it's the wrong vehicle. And it's somewhat akin to telling a community that you'll help them buy a fire truck if they'll support ending commercial whaling.
Cotter says the King Cove Road is a health and safety issue and has nothing to do with fish. APICTA has 14% of the CDQ pollock allocation, Coastal Villages Region Fund has 24%, and the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has 21%. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, trying to deal with trash after the flood in Galena.
We're deploying all kinds of interesting ideas to get the trash out of here. Whether that's put it on a boat, take it up river, offload it. We've talked about using a helicopter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Another surge of high water is pushing down the Yukon River, the result of this year's late spring. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says melting of a heavy snowpack into headwater tributaries in Canada is swelling the main river.
A lot of the snow didn't start melting till the very end, you know, till mid or late May. And we've been seeing that surge of water move into the state over the last week or so. And water levels on the Yukon are at some of their highest levels seen in a long time from snowmelt in early June.
Plum says the surge of high water has passed Eagle, where the river is reported to have crested yesterday. He says water remains high at the downriver communities of Stevens Village and Beaver, where there's been minor flooding in recent days. Plum says the crest will continue downstream over the next week and a half or so.
In Tanana and down in Galena, they're all reporting high water, especially for this time in June. And we're not expecting the water to go over bank in Galena and cause any more flooding, but certainly low-lying banks will have water over them, like the lowest banks, and a lot of sloughs that may not usually carry water will have water into them.
Plum says the river is carrying a lot of trees and other debris accumulated on islands and river bars. There's also been high water on some Fairbanks area rivers due to heavy rain this week. The Chena, Salcha, and Good Pasture rivers are all up. Galena residents are returning to see what's left of their flooded homes. And one thing they're finding is the rancid contents of freezers that stopped operation when the power plant went down. There's a dump down the road, but the road is washed out. During a community briefing yesterday, State Emergency Management Specialist Jeff Inginga said they are working on it, but it may be a while.
DOT said 2 to 3 weeks before that's going to be repaired. So we are actively working on getting this trash and debris problem addressed. We're deploying all kinds of interesting ideas to get the trash out of here. Whether that's put it on a boat, take it up river, offload it. We've talked about using a helicopter.
A trash truck has been positioned in a central part of town for people to deposit their bad meat, but it's filling up quickly, and officials say they're worried bears will soon be attracted. The Department of Environmental Conservation and Tanana Chiefs Conference are scheduled to bring in waste personnel to permit a temporary landfill and burn box. Inginga says the landfill will likely be located at the Galena Interior Learning Academy, which is right now being used to house and feed people. Today marks the 100-year anniversary of the first summit of Denali, known as Mount McKinley to many outside of Alaska. This year, more than 1,000 climbers will attempt to summit North America's highest peak. One group, however, has a particularly close link to the original 1913 party. KTNA's Philip Manning spoke with members of that group as they finalized preparations in Talkeetna.
Talkeetna is well known in the mountain climbing community as the primary departure point for Denali expeditions. The vast majority of those climbers fly from here to base camp located on the Kahiltna Glacier and begin their climb up Bradford Washburn's West Buttress route. One expedition that will soon be departing is taking a very different journey, however. Six climbers are finalizing preparations to follow in the footsteps of their forefathers, who were the first to summit Denali on June 7, 1913. They will be retracing the original route, which starts north of the mountain. Ken Karstens, descendant of original summit team member Harry Karstens, described the route, which begins at Wonder Lake and doesn't meet up with the more popular West Buttress route until the team has nearly reached the summit. Ken also explains how the process of gathering the team, whose families had spread throughout the country, took place.
Dan Hopkins climbed in 2008, and I saw an article, something online, and spent a year trying to track him down. It's just been a matter of hunting for years, trying to find everybody.
The expedition contains family representatives of all four members of the original summit team of Walter Harper, Harry Karstens, Hudson Stuck, and Robert Tatum. Ken Karstens and Ray Schuneman are descended from Harry Karstens. Alaska-born Dana Wright is a descendant of Walter Harper, the first man to set foot on the summit of Denali, and Sam Tatum represents Robert Tatum's family. The sixth member of the team is Sam Alexander of the Gwich'in tribe in Fort Yukon, who joined the team to represent the Alaska natives who made the trip possible for the Stuck party. Most of the team has very limited mountaineering experience. Of the six team members, only Dan Hopkins, great-nephew of Hudson Stuck, has stood on the summit of Denali before. He climbed the West Buttress in 2008 and describes the differences between this expedition and his previous climb.
Being completely isolated out there, I mean, you're in the wild and you're in one of the coldest mountains in the world. So, you know, we really got to pull together. Everybody just come together.
The team finishes preparations with Alaska Mountaineering School today, then departs for Denali National Park tomorrow, where they will be bused to Wonder Lake before beginning the 25-mile walk to the Muldrow Glacier and begin to climb Denali 100 years after their forefathers. The Denali 2013 team has a website and Facebook page that will allow people from around the world to track their progress as they attempt to repeat history. In Talkeetna, this is Philip Manning.
Special Olympics Alaska hosted a groundbreaking ceremony on Monday for a 20,000-square-foot expansion of their Sports, Health, and Wellness Center, where Governor Sean Parnell also signed House Bill 88 into law. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
This expansion will more than triple the size of Special Olympics Alaska's current facilities. Of course, there will be more workout space for athletes, but the organization's president and CEO, Jim Balamacy, says it will be much more than strictly a training facility.
We're finding out that once we get people on the, we've got people on the playing field now, we can provide more support in the health and nutrition, which will just make our guys even better off the playing field when they're in the work and in their community.
The new facility will give the athletes a chance to train more than once a week. It will help expand the school programs and give the organization a chance to offer courses on nutrition and basic health and wellness that could also be offered to the athlete's family and others. State Senator Lisa McGuire took part in the groundbreaking. She first got involved in Special Olympics Alaska after her brother suffered a traumatic brain injury during a head-on collision on the Seward Highway in the 1990s. She says the groundbreaking ceremony was an emotional moment for her.
That training center is going to bring so much joy to so many people's lives and to their families' lives. And that was another thing to see, was the joy on the siblings' faces, and who often are born without challenges. And so for them to be able to go to the training center alongside their brother or sister, and for the parents that are there, it's just wonderful.
Governor Parnell signed House Bill 88 into law during the gathering. The legislation eliminates the terms mentally retarded and mental retardation from state statutes, replacing the references with persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Jim Bellamacy says many people and groups, including Special Olympics Alaska, have been fighting the use of those terms for many years, and says this is a very significant step.
The slang word that came out of it was so hurtful for so many people for so many years, and I mean, there have been people who have been dedicating their lives for the last 30, 40 years to have that word changed, and we were just, and Special Olympics too, and we were just so honored to have that bill signed on our, not on our grounds, but for, it really was symbolic for people with disabilities in our state.
Bellamacy is anticipating the building to be complete sometime in February. Special Olympics Alaska serves over 2,000 athletes and involves over 1,000 volunteers annually. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
An official groundbreaking ceremony for the Port McKenzie Railroad Extension brought Governor Parnell and other state officials to Big Lake on Tuesday. When completed, the railroad project is expected to help move minerals and other products from the state's interior to tidewater in south central Alaska. The rail spur linking Port McKenzie to the Alaska Railroad's main line in Houston includes 32 miles of new rail. Port McKenzie is able to serve large ships and has the space to accommodate bulk resource storage. The entire rail spur project is expected to cost more than $270 million. About $141 million has been appropriated by the state legislature. The rail link could be completed by 2016.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ariel Van Cleve. This week on AK, the big day. In the world of birding, there are all kinds of lists and rules to go with them. One of those lists is the big day, where a birder tries to identify as many birds as they can in a single day. APRN's Dave Waldron embarked on a big day with one birder who wasn't just looking for birds, but redemption.
The first thing you should know about birding is that it starts really, really early.
It is 5:45 a.m. Way earlier than I usually get up on the weekends. I'm going to try and not wake the wife and the dog. Let's go find some birds.
I'm picked up by our guide today, Zach Clark. He's doing what birders call a big day. The guidelines are simple.
The guidelines. You have to be able to identify the birds within a 24-hour period.
birds can be added to a big day list two different ways, seeing them or hearing them. Although Clark has been a fan of birding for a while now, this is only his second big day. That's because his first one, which he was doing on the Potter's Marsh boardwalk, ended in disaster.
The heaviest part of my spotting scope swung out over the edge and plummeted 20 feet into the dirty, filthy water. So at that point, my big day came to an end and it became a rescue operation from my spotting scope.
It's been almost a year since that tragedy, and Clark is excited to give it another go.
If my spotting scope finishes the big day dry, then it'll be a success.
Today we're driving from Anchorage to Seward, but there's plenty of places along the way to get our list started. Our first stop is filled with seagulls.
So you got the mugul here. They got sort of a greenish tint to their legs. They got the smaller bill.
There are actually 5 different birds here. That's one thing you find out early about birding. There are so many you don't notice until you actually stand still and listen. By the time we arrive in Seward, our list is getting pretty long, right around 25. I ask Clark if there's one bird he really wants to find here today. He's resistant at first, but I do get it out of him.
Okay, I know earlier you said you'd jinx it if you said you wanted to find one specific bird, but would you be willing to tell me the bird?
Oh yeah, yeah, I wanted to find the chestnut-backed chickadee.
That search will have to wait, though. Chestnut-backed chickadees are mostly found in wooded areas, and there are a lot of seabirds to find in Seward, including one that Clark has never seen before.
Black guillemot?
Does it have a song? Can you play a song?
Let's see.
Clark fishes his phone out of his pocket and opens up a birding app to see if the song matches.
Did we hear it make it?
It's similar, yeah. You heard a little bit of that. Just like a little section of it. The white on the wings, black head. I think we got a successful identification. That'd be a new bird to add to my life list.
A life list, as you might guess, is the ultimate list for birders and documents every species they've seen. Clark says this matches his personality quite nicely.
I have this obsessive need to collect things. So when you're going out and you're spending a few hours, you can sort of collect the birds that you see and then not have to bring home anything physical. It's the search that's, you know, half the fun when you're collecting stuff like that.
And our search is nearing an end, but we have one last stop, the Mount Marathon Trail. We're hoping to add a few more birds to our list here, but the trees are thick with leaves this time of year, and it's hard to see anything.
Not only do you want to sort of train your eyes, but you got to work on your ears as well.
That part is easier said than done, but Clark is able to identify a few birds just by ear.
Guys close by. That's ruby-crowned kinglet. Really small. Here it comes.
As we trudge on, we realize it's getting late, and the birds have stopped singing.
It's pretty quiet. I don't know if I want to keep climbing up this mountain.
We decide we'll hike for 15 more minutes and then call it a day. And not long after, we hear a bird that stops Clark in his tracks.
It sounds like it's talking to somebody up here. Whatever it is, it's way up on the top of those spruce trees.
We can't see it, but after listening for a few minutes, we're almost certain that it's the chestnut-backed chickadee we were hoping to find.
That's what it has to be. It's like a chickadee on speed.
We want to be certain, so we consult the iPhone one last time.
Can we hear it one more time? That was it. That's our bird.
And that might just be the perfect end to our big day. But first I have to ask Clark the final total.
36? Not too bad. I'd love to be over 40.
We are able to find 4 more birds on our way back to Anchorage. And our final bird is so common that we can't believe we haven't seen it all day long. A pigeon. With 40 birds counted and a very dry spotting scope, I'm Dave Waldron.
And for 300 Villages this week, we're heading to a bird lover's paradise. It's the tiny town of Hyder on the border with Canada in southeast Alaska.
My name is Caroline Stewart. I am the proprietor of Boundary Gallery and Gifts.
My name is Wes Lowe. I'm the president of the Hyder Community Association and owner, and I run the Hyder General Store here.
Hyder is a small town. It was a boom town back in the 20s. There were some 10,000 people here, and Hyder survived the crash and the Great Depression. Unfortunately, when World War II broke out, in order to stabilize the economies, they capped and sealed the gold and silver mines, and the economic base of Hyder was indeed gold and silver. So by war's end, the population of Hyder had dropped to only 17 people and was on the roster of ghost towns in North America.
It's a very small community. It's a border town right off of Canada, actually just outside of Stewart, British Columbia. And the unique thing about Hyder is I think we're one of the only border crossings in the U.S. So as I say this, we're going to get customs, but we have no customs here. And we're one of the villages in Alaska that we don't have police, and we pretty much govern ourselves.
We are the most southerly part of Alaska you can drive to. We are 23 miles from the fifth largest glacier in North America. We're in a densely populated bear area, and we're on the Pacific Northwest Migratory Flightway, so we are indeed a bird watcher's paradise.
And this time of year, the bears are coming out, and we have a bear platform that is goes a couple hundred yards along a spawning stream, and you can walk out there and the browns and the blacks and even the wolves. We have wolves that go out there and get the fish.
There's trails to hike. The Portland Canal is both leisure and a great place to shop. It has salmon, halibut, prawns, crab, all of your bottom fish, so a lot of fishing.
It's unique. It's absolutely beautiful. And when people come in here, we get a lot of people from Europe, and they're just in awe of the glaciers, the animals, the wildlife, the ocean view, the river view.
Carolyn Stewart and Wes Lowe live in Hyder, Alaska. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron, Annie Feit, and Alex Duerre. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jeremy Scott in Galena, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The University of Alaska Southeast has web-based bachelor degree programs for first-time and transfer students. Learn online and work closely with advisors and experts in subjects like history, psychology, and anthropology. Cutting-edge technology prepares students for a variety of career paths, including graduate programs in teaching, counseling, and law. For more information, call Gail Klein at 228-4508. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.